Okay.
Really?
What?
How nice of you to come.
Okay, let's start with some prayer, and then we'll get in. Lord God, thank you for this Shabbat morning. Thank you for the blessing of rain here on this land. And we ask for your Spirit to be with us, inspire our thoughts and our hearts as we try to follow you and understand the word that you've given us. And just bless the service this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so if you've been on our website, you know that we're committed to doing the parasha this week.
Shalom.
Which is Shalom. Which is Genesis 28, up until the first few verses of chapter 32. And interestingly enough, we have Zach here this morning from Hong Kong, because this was a parasha exactly a year ago in Hong Kong.
Long way.
So it's a cycle. Oh my, where is my... Oh, I guess I have it here. Okay, so in this parasha, we have Jacob on the run. And what is the reason he's on the run?
Falling out with his brother.
It's a nice British way to put it.
Tiff.
Oh, yeah. A mild tiff. What's the other reason? What's the cover story of why he's leaving?
To find a proper wife.
Yeah, to find a wife. So we got two reasons. One, obviously, more urgent than the other. Okay, so to give us an outline of the parasha, we have Jacob fleeing. We have a dream that we're going to look at that happens at Beit El, which we have his famous Jacob's ladder. Then we have Genesis 29, first 14 verses, we have Jacob at the well with Rachel, or Rachel. After that, we have Jacob's marriage. Nice little controversial marriage to first Leah and then Rachel. Then the last verse of chapter 29 to half of chapter 30, we have Jacob's children being born. And that's key, of course, because they become the 12 tribes of Israel. So we have 11 sons born there. Then the end of chapter 30, we have a description of Jacob's flocks and how they're increasing. And that leads them to be called back to the land of Israel. And so chapter 31, we have Jacob on the run again, and this time fleeing from Laban, his father-in-law. And then he makes a covenant with Laban. And then he's preparing, at the end of his parasha, he's preparing to meet his brother again, Esav. So welcome, all you guys just getting here.
Good morning.
Good morning. We just gave an overview of the parasha we're looking at this morning, Vayitse, from Genesis 28:10 to 32:3. Welcome. There's still a seat up here. If anyone comes in, obviously. Wow, you just start talking and the table will fill. Verses. Who wants to read Genesis 10 through 22?
I'll do it.
Go for it.
Jacob left Beersheba and headed to Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down. He had a dream, and while he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top to the heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you, and I will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called the place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth.
Nice. So, a lot of little interesting things we could look at in this story. First, does it say where the place is at the beginning of the story?
It's on the way to Haran from Bethel.
On the way to Haran from Beersheba.
Beersheba.
What does it say? Jacob did what? The very beginning. He went out and then?
Vayifga.
He bumped into a place. It's very curious, huh? He bumped into a place. It was just there. And he bumped into it. Vayifga bamakom. If you follow in this little pericope, in this little story of the ladder, you'll see the word, the place, mentioned many times. Let's see if I can... Who can count them? In just the story of the ladder, how many times is the place mentioned?
Being number two, so not a good.
No, this land
not
is Haaretz.
Yeah.
You only have Haaretz being number two?
I put six times.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
six.
Something.
I counted five.
A certain place, does that count?
Yeah, that counts. Mm-hmm. A certain place, that should be your first.
But it needs to be seven.
Yeah, it needs to be seven. Who can make it seven? No.
It's 10 o'clock.
Thank you.
Three times in verse 11.
So here's my question. Why does it keep talking about this place, this place?
It's the house of God. The Lord is in this place. It's probably really... If you find a place that's called the house of God by God, or no, I guess it's Jacob who said it, that's significant.
It is significant. What does the name Bet El mean?
House of God.
House of God, right. When we say house of God, what do we usually think of?
Church.
Yeah, okay, well, what would you have thought of in the days that the Bible is being written?
A temple.
Where one encounters God. A temple.
But not in this time. There was no temple.
I don't know.
There was no.
You're saying in Jacob's time there was no temple like Solomon's temple for God. Right. Mm-hmm.
But.
But there were other temples.
But there were other temples. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And certainly to be a temple in the ancient world, you don't have to have the big, Herodian stones and all of that. You could have a smaller.
Mm-hmm. There were multiple places. A stone there. So
the whole story, you have hints of this being a future significant place of meeting with God. And one of those may even be the word makom. If you guys have studied, is anyone familiar with rabbinic writings?
Mm-hmm.
So what is makom? What does that
mean? It's the place. It is
a place.
It is a temple.
Well, there's even more.
It's the presence of God.
It's God himself. It's a euphemism for God himself. Hamakom.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is much later, of course. So that's an interpretation. But it's interesting that makom keeps being stressed in this passage. Also, if you remember in the book of Esther, at the critical time, the author clearly doesn't use the word God, but he says, help will come from
another place.
Another place. Right. And that's maybe one of the reasons, that's in chapter 4 somewhere in Esther. One of the reasons maybe why this rabbinic interpretation that the place is a euphemism for God. Okay, so he bumps into this place.
Mm-hmm. I count six. I can't find the seven.
Yeah, we're stuck at six there. Maybe the seventh is the culminating name, the Bet El. All of a sudden you've gone from a euphemism to the name itself. Okay, so he sets up a stone. And why does the story mention this?
Well, first it's impressive that he slept on it.
Right. Okay.
Because how can you sleep on it?
It doesn't say he slept on it.
Oh, he had it under his head.
No, it doesn't say that.
What does it say?
It says he took from the stones of the place.
Read in Hebrew.
Okay. I'll read in Hebrew. Vaykach me'avnei ha-makom, vayasen me'ra'ashotav, vayishkav ba'makom ha-hu. So he took from the stones of the area, or the place, he put it up in the area of his head, and he slept in that place. So, really it sounds more like he set up a big stone as some kind of, I don't know,
windbreaker,
some kind of protection. Me'ra ashotav, in the area of his head. It's the same kind of construction as you would have in the book of Ruth, where she uncovers Boaz. It says margelotav, in the area of his legs. So this is one of those, that general area. So it doesn't say he put it under his head.
But where does that come from?
The Hebrew Bible doesn't say that.
Right.
Bible does.
Oh, yours does? What translation do you have?
NIV.
NIV. Wow.
Yeah, he put it under his head and laid down to sleep.
Uh-huh.
Did you check the Septuagint?
I'm
not saying it's right.
But mine says the same.
Epic empros kephalesavtu. Ke ekimefe entotopo akinos. No. Pros. Toward. The Greek has toward his head. So.
But read from the Jacob's letter, the pseudepigraphum.
The pseudepigraphum?
I think the windbreaker word is phenomenal because it is putting at his head.
Yeah.
And just, nice English translations don't really understand that, so let's stick it under his head and make it a pillar.
Right, which doesn't really make so much sense.
But there's even ancient interpretation that does that.
That he put it under his head.
That's what you're going to be great.
I wasn't going to, but I can.
But there's earlier tradition for putting it under his head, but...
Gary's saying there's an early tradition for putting it under his head as a pillow. Albeit not a very comfortable pillow.
even though some people claim you could get a nice soft rock and it would prop up your head in a certain way. Okay, so he has a dream. Notice also hine in this place. You all know the word hine in Hebrew? Hine, when I'm pointing to something like, here it is. It can be used in a story to draw your attention. It can be a break structure that slows down, so it can be used in a dramatic pause, or it can be used to point out something significant. And look at verse 12 and following. Within three verses we have hine three times. Actually within two verses. He dreamt and hine, there's a tsulam. And then hine, God is on it.
Yeah, it's the verb comes and then behold. He dreamed, yeah. Behold.
Yeah.
And then he, there, behold.
It slows down the story. It kind of is, it focuses. Like slow motion almost.
Right, and like, and instead, behold the Lord.
Yeah.
Different.
So this is kind of, it's quite, we're all surprised and staring at this phenomenon. Then we have the little sulam. So I liked, which translation did you read from?
I read from the NIV.
The NIV?
Mm-hmm.
So it said stairway. Have you guys been down Herzog Road here in Jerusalem by the Valley of the Cross? Have you ever seen Jacob's ladder?
Maybe. No.
It's a pesel.
Sculpture or statue.
And it's a staircase that's kind of tipped though, so you can't actually climb up it. Going straight like that up into the sky. Pretty tall. Like, I don't know how many stories.
I always say it's designed such a way that the angels can get up and down it, and the kids can't get up.
And the kids can't. The angels can get up and down, the kids can't.
Yeah.
That's right. So why is it a staircase? First let me ask, how many of you guys have ladders in your translation?
Because what's this?
Mm-hmm.
It says a ladder.
A ladder, also.
Mm-hmm.
But this the only time Sulam appears in the Old Testament.
Exactly.
So does Sulam mean ladder in the Old Testament offer, or is it just a word that...
Last word.
Well, we only get it once, so it's a little hard to define.
I think we get the word ladder from the Greek.
From Klimas? Yeah. However, it translates it klimax, which, depending who you look at, they say ladder or stair. So it could still go either way. But I was also checking in the Latin Vulgate, and yeah, the Vulgate has scala in the singular, which is interesting because in older Latin, scale in the plural referred to stairs, but then later in the Latin language, they would use it in the singular, and it would be only ladder. Where originally it could be ladder or stairs, basically anything you climb on. And then later it became just ladder. So when they're translating the Bible and they use scala, then that's pretty much just ladder.
So you think he's picturing the ladder, or is he picturing a ziggurat?
Well, what do you think?
I think he's picturing a ziggurat, because if you're going to say this is the house of God, or the place of the temple, I think it's going to look like other pagan temples at the time.
A ziggurat is
it? Right.
A ziggurat
is
a temple.
So I think that's what
I
see.
Yeah, I would. I think a staircase is a very plausible thing that he's looking at, because angels are going up and down, and when you think of angels or ministers of God, you could compare it on earth to priests going up and down temple steps. Also, you can think practically, if you just have a ladder, it's kind of hard for two people to be going up and down at the same time. You can try that out and see if it works.
Yeah, this stairway, of course, I would have been broad.
Because the angels have actually got to come from somewhere. So if it's a ladder, it goes nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just think of the Gila.
Well, yeah.
But was it a vision or something practical?
Well, it says it is a dream.
Vision.
A dream.
Yeah, so vision can...
It cannot make sense then?
Well, if you had a vision, you'd see it disappearing into
the
end of it.
We do say, it says specifically, mutsav arza. It's firmly set up on the ground, and its head reaches until the heaven. Like, what other structure does that?
The ziggurat.
And what else in our Bible?
Babel.
Tower of Babel.
Tower of Babel, also. Same description.
Yeah.
Which is also back in the country of ziggurat.
And just that makes sense. At the top of the temple, that's where you go and meet with God and the other holy
languages.
It's just everything that God's trying to keep.
Because you're going up into the sky. And what our friend here was pointing out, you have to start from somewhere. Notice that the angels, it says they are going up and going down on it. Is that interesting?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
They're going up first. They're going up and going down.
Yeah, but you said something about going up first.
Yeah, it mentions going up first.
They're starting on the ground.
It doesn't say they're going down and going up. It's saying they're going up and going down. So the implication is they started on the bottom. That's just an interesting little thing. This story captured interpreters' attention for several reasons. First, the fact that it's a dream. How did God speak to Abraham?
That's perfect. He showed up.
Apparently, yeah. He showed up, he spoke. Well, we don't actually know, but the way it's recorded in our stories is that God spoke to Abraham, and then we just have direct speech.
There's a dream in Genesis 15, though.
There is a dream. He has a vision when he has the sacrifices between the two pieces of animals.
But at the same time, before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, he just showed up.
He showed up.
Physically.
Somehow, physically, because it says he turned around and talked to Abraham. Yeah, and so here, this is our first instance where God is meeting with Jacob. And it's in a dream. So some commentators said, well, why the dream? Why didn't he just speak to him? And why the ladder? You know, what... Surely there must be more meaning. If God just wanted to say something, he could have just said it. So why did he have this dream? And so interpreters say, well, there must be something else about the dream to know. And so what does it become? It becomes a vision of the end times.
Of course.
Of course. And they have a lot of fun with interpreting each of these stairs or steps. Or if you take the ladder, each of these rungs. And so there's a whole little... Have any of you read the pseudepigrapha?
Mm-hmm.
There's a little, I guess you call it a book, called The Ladder of Jacob. And it describes... It apparently dates back to somewhere 1st century AD. And it describes this ladder or staircase. And it gives meaning that there's spaces on each level, and it relates it to the different kingdoms. And different kingdoms rise, they go up a few stairs, they go back down. And the other thing about this that people, it stuck out to people, was that he's so afraid afterwards. So he said, well, if it's the angels of God, why is he so afraid? And again, it's because he's seen a vision of the future. And of course, people coming up with these ideas are living in the kingdom of Rome. So for them, one of the staircases was Rome, and it kept ascending. And so he was afraid, like, is there ever going to be a stop to this Roman Empire? And, of course, the answer is yes. But I don't know if he's given the details.
Is the fear also linked to the fact that he's actually has to
I think for sure. On the plain reading of it, if this is Jacob's first encounter with God,
yeah,
and it's an amazing encounter, I would be afraid as well. He's seen messengers. In his response, this must be the gate to heaven. I mean, that's a huge thing. If I had such a dream, I would probably be at least scared in the sense of in awe. Especially when it says, and behold, God was standing on it.
Or on he has him. Both. He's afraid. He says, how awesome is this place? I mean, that very right. Word is just huge.
Ma Nora. Nora, you could translate awesome, and you could translate awful.
Yeah.
Fearful. God uses this word also to define his miracles. You know, the miracles in the Exodus and in giving of the law, where there is that fear. Like when the law was given, there was a huge storm, there was earthquake. It was not for the timid. Remember, all the people are so afraid, they don't even want to meet God. They say, Moses, you go up and meet him. We'll just take your word for it. And this is the first time Jacob not only meets God, but he gets the same promise that beforehand God had given to Abraham and Isaac. Jacob takes his place in his lineage, you could say. And he gets the same promise of inheriting the land that he's lying on, which in his case is Bet-El, but you could extend it. As it says, you're going to break forward west and east and north and south. And all peoples of the earth, all families, will be blessed by you and your seed. And another Hine, if you look in verse 15, and behold, or here, I'm with you and I'm going to keep you. All right. So Jacob calls a place the house of God and the gate to heaven. And he immediately sets up the rock. It's interesting, when he's calling the name, he makes a vow. What is his vow like? How would you describe it?
Conditional. In the sense, if God holds his up, holds his in about, then I'll accept him.
Yeah, after all of that, it's kind of strange that he would put such a condition. And God has just promised to be with him.
But it was a dream.
It was a dream, okay.
But Jacob's character is still pretty shady. I mean, he's been manipulating Esau the entire time, and now he's like, well, okay, if I can get a little bit more out of this, if I can get God with me, and he'll protect me, provide me, and guide me.
And clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually he doesn't even mention a wife here. He just asks for bread to eat and clothes to wear. So he's really just thinking survival.
Well, and then keep me on this way. And it's kind of, I think it's interesting because that's what in Deuteronomy that God says to the people. And that shall I'll provide for you, protect you, and guide you.
And he says, if God helps me return to my father's house,
only then.
Then God will be my God. And he uses the personal name of God, will be for me a God.
We should also know that this is his first encounter with the Lord.
Yeah.
And considering his age also.
What do you think his age is here?
Well, he was still young.
Still young?
Yes. By this,
I think he's old.
He's an adult. Remember when Abraham wanted to get Isaac a wife, Isaac was 40.
Yes.
So we don't have the age of Jacob, but it could be he's not a young youth. It could be he's certainly an adult. He's going off by himself.
Well, we may consider it based on the way we look at our own age these days.
Yeah.
That someone at 40 is an adult.
Yeah.
But comparing to their own time, someone at 40 is still
a youth.
is still a youth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So, and also knowing that this is the first experience, he had never encountered God.
Mm-hmm.
All he is after is what will fill up his belly and clothing for himself. Mm-hmm. So that could influence the way he made this kind of vow.
The other interesting thing to note is we looked last week at a parasha and the servant that goes to find Rebecca, what does he come with?
Gold, silver,
what else?
Fruits.
What's he riding on? Camels.
Camels.
Those are expensive. A lot of them. Didn't he mention 10 camels?
Mm-hmm. 10.
So he has and of course there's going to be other people helping out with those camels. So he has this whole entourage with him. Mm-hmm. Looks pretty formidable, like a caravan. Here, we don't have any mention of that. We have Jacob falling asleep. Doesn't even say, you know, he tied up his donkey. You know, we hear nothing. We just hear of him.
Yeah.
So maybe it's much more of he's a fugitive and he's alone. And we had mentioned before that going across that trip back through home, you could be accosted by, you know, thieves. All kinds of things could befall you.
Uh-huh.
And so he seems much less protected than the first voyage back. Okay.
So that's very interesting, isn't it? Because that means one puts oneself into that situation. The only thing you actually think about at that moment is survival.
Uh-huh. Right.
So if God, if you hang on to me and you give me clothes and you give me food and you get me through this, you don't even really realize where you're going to.
Yeah.
Then you'll be my God. Uh-huh. It's not quite as conditional, I don't think. I think it's...
Well, it's conditional, but you're saying it's a legitimate need because he is by himself.
Yeah.
There's this autobiography called Dove. It's about this kid when he was 16. He sailed around the world. And it turns into a Christian novel when he gets around Cape of Good Hope or mm-hmm. South Africa. And he gets into a hurricane. And it's his autobiography. He says, "All right, God, if you get me out of this hurricane, I'll serve you. I'll follow you." And in his autobiography, he says, "I passed out and woke up on the beach. And I thought it was beach. And I was singing."
Right.
Because that's how I found God. You know?
We also have the sailors in the book of Jonah.
Right.
They make vows.
Right.
And a neder is by definition, if you do this, I will do this. So he's making a neder, a vow with God. And also you look at the last verse of the chapter. He also promises to tithe.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's a foreshadowing that Beit El might be a place of established worship because there's a tithe going on. That's something you would do at a temple, not just at your house. And to be able to tithe means you're going to get something.
Mm-hmm.
So we've touched on Jacob's character. I think you mentioned that he's crafty. And yet he's also the one in God's promise. So you have this tension based on his name. What does his name mean? Or let's say, what does the root of his name mean? Because you could take it several ways. Sorry, what was it?
Grabbing?
Well,
deceiver.
The name Ekev means heel. Mm-hmm. So you could just take it, that's kind of a neutral way, because he grabbed the heel of his brother. But a lot of writers in the Bible play with it. If you read Hosea, you know, Akub, it can be to trick people too, to be a little bit deceptive or a little bit not straightforward. And that's interesting because if you take his name Yisrael, you can play with that as well. There are conjectures to what Yisrael, which root it really comes from. You can take it Sarita im Elohim, you struggled with God at the end of the next parasha, the end of chapter 32.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also look at the first three letters, and it kind of reminds you, if you just write it out, I don't have a pen here. Yashar, what does Yashar mean?
Straight.
It also means honest, upright. So you have this guy, if you have both those names, they can be contrasted together. You have his kind of crafty side, and you have his straight, upright, powerful side. So that's interesting as you're reading through the whole story, how you see the author is playing with those meanings of his name. And what, where in the New Testament does the staircase of Jacob get mentioned?
John 2.
Yeah, actually, John 1:50, but John 1. Basically chapter 2. You want to look there? John chapter 1, verse 50. This is when Nathanael is being called. And Jesus, well, let's go to verse 47 and read it. Or even, how far back should we go?
43,
okay. So, on the next day, Jesus wanted to set out for Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the town of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the Law and the Prophets. And the Prophets also wrote about, Jesus of Nazareth, son of Joseph." Nathanael replied, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip replied, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and exclaimed, "Look, a true Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "How do you know me?" Jesus replied, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." So king here, of course, is a messianic title. Jesus said to him, "Because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." He continued, "I tell all of you the solemn truth. You will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." So, how is Jesus interpreting the story of Jacob?
How is Jesus interpreting this story?
The story of Jacob.
I think John really thinks Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And there's no one to follow except through
him. I think so too.
So I think he's saying, "I'm the way to God."
Right? Who? Okay, but let's take it back to the basic metaphor. Who is Jesus?
The staircase ladder.
The staircase slash ladder. Right. And actually, I think in that same ladder of Jacob, they kind of have a later additions embellishing this whole concept of the incarnation, because a ladder or staircase is connecting the two spheres, the earthly with the heavenly. And so it was Jesus who connected the earthly things with the heavenly and made it possible for that connection to happen again.
Could that be similar to what also was shown to the shepherds when Christ was born? The angels descending and ascending, singing?
Maybe. I mean, it's not written that way, just okay. That there was a host of angels in the sky.
Yes.
But that would be interesting. And here Jesus is talking about something in the future, in the sense of a full revelation of who he is.
Yes.
But certainly, yeah, there were angels to announce his birth. What else are they going to say? There's a funny interpretation on the back to the ladder in Targum Neofiti, which is one of the Aramaic. It's a later Aramaic translation. That the angels actually wanted to see who Jacob was. I'll read it for you, translated to English. "And the angels who had accompanied him from his father's house went up to announce to the angels on high, Come and see the righteous man Jacob, whose likeness is set upon the divine throne, the one whom you have wanted to see. Then the holy angels of God went up and down to gaze upon him. So the reason the ladder appears is because the angels are curious who this guy is. But also in this translation, you see a hint at interpreting the fact that it starts going up before coming down. Mm-hmm. So who was going up? It was the guardian angels that were going with Jacob on his way. And they went up to talk to the other angels and came back down. So that's a fun interpretation, but it's also dealing with details of the text that we notice and ask ourselves, you know, why is it that it says ole, it says going up before coming down?
Are you going to talk about Son of Man at all?
Son of Man deserves at least one Bible study unto itself, but what would you like to mention about Son of Man?
I just think it's beautiful that I think Jesus is also pulling off Daniel 7:13.
For sure, I would agree.
And especially in that context, that one like the Son of Man is appearing before the Ancient of Days, I think it also fits in this theme that John is saying. He is the way to heaven, subtly here, before he says, I am the way. And then also it's the one who appears before Father. So not only is he the way, but he's the one between, he's the mediator between God and man.
And both of them are from visions.
Yeah.
And they're both a picture of the Father, of God.
Yeah.
And yet in two persons, so to speak. There's the throne, and one like the Son of Man coming on the clouds in Daniel. So it's a divine being, but somehow seen as two parts, you could say. What were you saying?
I was just going to ask, do we know that, because you know, it says the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Does that mean that he is the staircase, or that they are descending, ascending and descending onto him?
That's a point of interpretation, and that takes us back to the words. They're talking about Alav.
Right.
You could say it either refers back to the Sulam or to Jacob in the original story. So, but most probably Sulam, so on the ladder. So in that parallel, then Jesus would be the ladder part. But it's open to go both directions with that.
Is there any indications that we'd have for either way?
Well, just your straight common sense reading. Sorry, wait, let me go back to that. And while I'm pulling up the place again, this is Jesus' favorite title of himself, Son of Man. And there are people who say it's not always referring to Daniel 7, and maybe in a few cases in the Gospel you would have the phrase not referring to it, but I think it's very clearly mostly referring to Daniel 7 as some kind of messianic title that Jesus is using.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so verse 10, ויצא יעקב מבאר שבע וילך ארונה ויפקע במקום וילן שם כי בא השמש ויקח מאבני המקום ויתמרחותיו וישקע במקום ההוא ויחלום והנה סולם מוצב ארצה וראשו מגיע השמיים והנה מלאכי אלוהים עולים ויורדים בו והנה אדוני ניצב עליו. Okay, so actually it's a bow. Yordim bo. So that would refer most. I don't see why we would take it not to mean the Sulam. But then Adonai Nitzav Alav, he's standing on it. So God is standing on this staircase. Or you could say standing on him. If you were to, maybe that's the Alav we're looking for, that would refer back to Jacob.
Yeah, but that's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. That would be a foot in the door if you wanted to make a crazy interpretation.
No, my question is more just with the quotation in John.
Yeah.
You know, in Greek it's epitan huion to anthropou. And
anthropou.
I'm thinking, is that I like the idea of him being the staircase,
mm-hmm.
but I'm wondering, is there a validity to them ascending and descending onto him? I'm thinking of Epi in the sense of being a pawn.
Well, who is the him? That's the question.
Right.
Because
on the son of.
Because there is the son of man.
Son of man. Mm-hmm.
I mean, on Epi doesn't have to be on to, it can just be on.
Right.
So normally when you say, even in English, you're climbing on a ladder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or on a staircase. It's something.
It's a Greek preposition.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Well,
this is true.
Prepositions in any language are like that, yeah. So, I mean, if you wanted to do something different, a different interpretation, you could maybe, but I think the most straightforward is Jesus is calling himself the Son of Man and calling himself that ladder at the same time. So he's pulling out those two metaphors.
I also like that if we're not going to take it as a ladder, but more of a temple.
A staircase, figure, right.
A staircase, a ziggurat. And he's also saying, I am the temple of God. He's the place where, destroy this temple and 3 days I'll raise it. Again, in John.
Yeah, we have another precedent for calling himself a temple of God. So the place where humans and God would meet is in Jesus. Right, yeah.
It's a theme.
Okay. I don't think we'll be able to go forward with anything more.
No.
Because we won't ever be able to complete it. But how many of you read this parasha during the week? Good.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, it's a great, crazy parasha you can keep going back to and getting stuff out of. I noticed in my reading that, well, I checked on the name Rachel. What does Rachel mean, Rachel's name?
Forget it.
No? It means a little lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's only about 4 places that it refers to the little lamb as opposed to the name Rachel in the whole Bible. And curiously, 2 of those places are in the Jacob and Laban story. So again, you have these plays on people's names. So I had never noticed before that there's only 2 out of 4 times, and they're both in, you know, Genesis 31:38 and Genesis 32:15 have the flocks, even referring to Laban's little lambs. And we have the other time is in Isaiah 53:7 and Song of Solomon 6:6, where her hair is like the flocks, as Rachel. What about Leah? What does her name mean?
Commies.
Beautiful. Leah?
Beautiful. It's weak eyes.
Well, it depends. Again, these names, usually you can interpret it several directions. But if you say in Hebrew, la'a, the verb la'a, hu yil'e, it's to be weary or sick of something or tired.
Mm.
So, that's an interesting little play too. And we had it in our parasha a couple weeks back in Genesis 19:11. If you remember, we were reading, well actually we didn't read it in the parasha, we referred to it. But the people of Sodom come to Lot's house and then the angels strike them with sanverim. They zap them, blind them. And then right after that, what does it say? They couldn't find the doorway. And in the Hebrew it says, nil'u, limtzoa petach. So they were unable, they were too weak, or they were unable to find the doorway. So it's the same root used there.
So what does Leah mean?
Leah?
Yeah.
It could mean kind of weak or tired, or it's also the word God uses when he says, you know, I'm sick of this. In Isaiah 1:14, let's go there. I hate your new moon festivals and assemblies. They are a burden that I am tired of carrying. That's that word. That's in the Nifal, but mil'eti niso. I'm tired of carrying it. So to be tired, sick, weak. and of course, a lot of times when we read the story, we're told In her case, we're not told the name, but if we're told a name, sometimes during the story we have a synonym and not the name itself. And so we have mention of her eyes being not actually weak with this word, but soft. And the question is, what does that mean? Soft eyes, you could say, you could interpret it positively, negatively. I've heard all kinds, like, you know, she has poor vision, or maybe they're light colored and that wasn't esteemed, you know, all kinds of interesting interpretations. But, yeah, so go back through, and as you're reading the parasha, especially for those of you, I see a lot of parallel Bibles here, if you can try to read it in Hebrew, you might notice some of these things. And if you can't read it in Hebrew but you'd like to, talk to me and I can help you out there. I have some books that you can study.
Teach us Hebrew.
Well, I can hand you a book that might do a good job in that direction. But it's great food for thought. Does anyone have any final words on the Sulam Yaakov?
I don't know what that word means, but just for one word, in England we have a saying that a place is... it's gone out of my mind. Anyway, it means that it's close to heaven. Mm-hmm. It feels close to heaven. And it's often a place of prayer.
Place of prayer?
Yeah, but often place of prayer. Or places yeah. where something miraculous has happened.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a universal...
It is universal, yes.
...idea. And even to go up to a temple, or having a structure where you go up, where there's this connection between earth and heaven. Or in the early Christian domes, you know, the dome is colored the color of sky to kind of show that it's a blend between earth and heaven. Yeah. Let me just check if I... Yeah. So we'll end there and just continue reading on your own through the parasha. Next week we're going to shift gears and start looking at the birth narratives. So we're going to start with Matthew's genealogy next week. So if you want to prepare, you can read through that.
Great. Thanks for reading. Good job.